With that, I will turn it over to Jeff.
Well, I feel bad, Bob, that you are all ready to go tonight, and maybe you'd like to add some things at the end. It'd be nice to hear from you too, and of course, everybody. This is a opportunity to discuss this fourth grave precept, and I'm going to approach this 28, 30 minutes of time by first talking a little bit about what it's meant to me to accept the precepts, and then I'm going to share a few thoughts of what I've learned and some comments from authors about how one might pursue a path for the rest of one's life in practicing the precepts. And then I'm going to look at that fourth precept itself and share a few thoughts from teachers about what we might understand about that precept. And then finally, I'm going to wrap up sharing a few thoughts again from teachers and maybe a little bit about my own experience about how to focus one's practice on that fourth precept. And then we'll have about 25 minutes of time to discuss that. So I decided to accept the precepts after having practiced Buddhism for some years, and I decided I wanted to make a personal and public commitment to the path of the precepts. And for me, this act of taking this step meant that I was making a decision to kind of point my life in the direction of the precepts. For me, this direction represented a kind of higher power, if you will, feeling that there was something there in Buddhism and the practice and the path of the precepts that was simply right. It felt like the right thing to do. But on a deeper, kind of less intellectual level, it felt similar to how I was drawn to my vocation. And this felt like dedicating myself to the precepts had a sort of obvious and necessary aspect to it at sort of a gut level. So that's a little bit about why I decided to go down this path. In preparing for this and in reading some of the references that are on the website about the precepts, I thought it was quite interesting what some of these authors had to say about the practice of precepts. Kjogan Carlson has written a pamphlet on the precepts, and he's one of Domio's former teachers, and it's titled The 16 Bodhisattva Precepts, and again, it's available on the website. And he says that we are ready to receive or commit to the precepts when we are ready to acknowledge them as our path. He uses that word path. And I think he means that as we engage in contrition, when we realize that we need to change. And I think we take a crucial risk when we decide that there's something deeper and we choose to pursue the Dharma and the precepts. I interpret some of his comments in this essay as meaning that we have this opportunity to choose. And it's important that we embrace that power. And I think this path, as he speaks to it, is something we can spend the rest of our lives on. And I think the path can be a kind of compass that can steer us in a particular direction, keep us on path, help us detect when we're off path, and help us with this process of lifelong self-discovery. He talks about the precepts as having a rule component on the most superficial level, and talks about how the precepts arose as a way of governing original communities of monks and nuns, but as the precepts have been practiced more and more over the years, there's this deeper aspect of the precept that we're also invited to try and understand. As we'll review these precepts that we have a comment after the first line, traditionally by Dogen, and then another comment after that by Bodhidharma. And as Kogan points out, embedded within these comments is a koan, and a mystery that suggests we'll not be able to keep the precept perfectly, and that there may be some challenges deeply embedded in each of those precepts. I understand that we're to sit with these precepts while at the same time moving along this path. And as we do that, I believe we'll encounter our habits and our karma. And with practice, I think we have this opportunity to recognize these patterns perhaps sooner and sooner as our moments and our life unfolds. And as we recognize these patterns, we may be able to make some choices with less reaction. As Kjogan Carlson says, I like this particular quote, choosing to engage in the messiness of life and following it to touch us is doing good for others in a profound way. Switching to another author, although this is not a Buddhist author, this is David Brooks. He recently wrote a book, The Second Mountain. You may recognize him as a commentator. He's on the PBS NewsHours fairly often. And I found this book interesting because he suggests that after we scale his first metaphoric mountain, pursuing interests of our ego, things like attaining goals, acquisition, worldly praise, we may discover a different, more lofty peak. And this second mountain, as he describes it, is a calling. He describes it as a spiritual journey where all people are recognized for their whole self. He actually uses that word, whole self, and the importance of loving kindness, and that this is one's deepest purpose. So I found a lot of interesting parallels between his writing and our Buddhist writers. One of the books that I read pertaining to this precept is Waking Up to What You Do by Diane Eshin-Rosetto. Again, this is on the website. And she offers several principles about how to practice the precepts and incorporate them into our life. And I found several of these to be very thought-provoking and helpful to me anyway. She emphasizes this point that we're, again, responsible for our choices and behaviors, and that we can wake up to our motivations and our inner selves. She speaks about how the precepts help us access native intelligence to make good choices, and that sitting meditation will foster self-awareness, which will lead to seeing our choices more clearly over time. She speaks about the knowledge that understanding of useful action emerges from the most ordinary events of everyday life and in the situation we want to avoid the most. I thought that was kind of an interesting point, that we all have these situations or moment-to-moment dynamics and that we experience, and she suggests that we each may have certain sensitive spots there and things that we want to avoid the most. And she speaks about those perhaps being some of our best teachers. She talks about there is not a correct action formula that allows every action to be correct, even though the precept in some ways have a rule-oriented aspect. And she says, quote, the precepts encourage us in the spirit of open questioning to unveil our deepest beliefs that define for us the shape and limitation of how we view who we are. She speaks about how they are tools to help free us from domination by the ever-changing stream of thoughts, feelings, and sensations. And she speaks about them being written in the form of a riddle, because they deal with infinitely complex matters where in any particular situation, there may not be a simple yes or no answer. And she suggests we're intentionally invited to make our own discernment of each precept. She speaks about the precepts teaching us about the interconnectedness of all things. And she spoke about the metaphor of Indra's net. You may know of this metaphor. Some people describe this as being something like a spider's web with dewdrops of moisture scattered about the spider's web. Each little dewdrop representing a being. And if you look very closely at each dewdrop, you can see reflected in that dewdrop every other dewdrop in the spider's web. I think in the Indra's net metaphor, each little point representing a being is a jewel. Again, reflecting every other jewel, pointing out that we're all connected. And another writer, Robert Aiken, in The Mind of Clover, writes about this: the net of Indra inspires me to regard the universe as a great communication workshop in which you and I practice the expression of compassionate truth with all beings and encourage that practice in others toward ourselves. So he goes on to talk about the idea that one of the reasons we might practice the precepts is that we're ultimately all connected. And if we appreciate that every action we take, everything we do, can relate back to a precept and ultimately to each other, that can, it feels a little daunting to me to think of it that way. And at times potentially overwhelming, but it's also a pretty cool idea that ultimately we're connected back to each other through the challenges we face in these precepts. So let's look at this fourth grave precept specifically. We read that at the top of this meeting. I'll read it again. Do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. In the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. The Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is neither surplus nor lack. The sweet dew covers the earth, and within it lies the truth. As I reviewed these comments by Dogen and Bodhidharma, I understand Dogen's comment about the Dharma encompassing all things as meaning that it is beyond our comprehension, and any attempt to understand its ultimate truth will be impossible. And Bodhidharma talks about the Dharma existing before all things in the comment about the Dharma wheel turning from the beginning. He goes on to say there's neither surplus nor lack. I understand that to mean that the Dharma is complete as it is. The comment, the sweet dew, is referring to the Dharma, and it is everywhere, penetrates everything, and it is just as it is, and beautiful just as it is. Diane Eshin Rezito has a few interpretive comments about this that I thought were helpful. She says, simply honest speech tells us how it really is in the moment. And she says that deception includes, quote, both what we tell others and ourselves. So it's not just how we interact with the world and whether we're speaking honestly to external entities or others. And I can relate to this point. I find myself at times telling myself stories, I call them, about a situation that may be developing. And as I've explored this, I think my vulnerability there is that I tell myself stories when I'm most feeling most vulnerable about being responsible for something, where I convince myself that I need to be fearful because what's transpiring, I may be responsible for that. I may have made a mistake or something. So I think I have a habit of mind there that can actually result in me telling a lie to myself about what's going on. She goes on to say, silence has value when aiming to be truthful. And it can be helpful to ask the basic question, will my words help or hurt the situation? As a way of discerning, what am I about to say? Is it going to be helpful or not? As a way to think about, is this going to be truthful or not? She also speaks about it being useful to be comfortable, as she says, with not knowing. And I understand her to challenge us with the question, can our spoken truth be to say, I don't know? She speaks, I think, very effectively about how attracted we are to certainty. And that may represent for us the notion that that is where we will find safety in certainty. And she shares a story that I got a kick out of. She tells a story about the Zen master is asked, where is the truth? And he replies, it just moved. I got a kick out of that. she talks about how the precepts cannot provide a recipe for certainty. They can, quote, only serve us to the extent that they help us face the truth of our actions from moment to moment. The moment of choice is to distort or not distort, and that's our practice. John Dado Laurie in The Heart of Being says the precepts come from no self. So when we don't speak the truth, we are protecting ourselves in some way. He also says every lie violates the precept, but in certain circumstances, we may tell a lie to protect someone. And so this may be one of these koans or complexities embedded in this precept. He says, on the other hand, if the lie is to protect the self, then we are violating the precept. He also said, the truth depends on where you sit. And this is one of the complexities with this precept. Therefore, even giving rise to a thought, let alone speaking that something is true or false, may violate this precept. Kjogan Carlson says, the key opportunity is more of minimizing harm as opposed to perfect speech, perfectly truthful speech. Again, here's this koan aspect of the fourth precept. And then finally, a few thoughts about practicing the fourth precept in particular. Diane Eshin-Rizzetto talks about, quote, be an observer, not a judge of the self. Judgment tends to shut down open inquiry. And she talks about how with practice, we can notice our deceptive behavior more quickly. And with repetition of noticing and open probing with questions, open-ended questions, which I recall Domio teaching us many times, then, as she says, the insight will emerge when you are ready. Again, cultivating the spirit of compassion, openness, curiosity, acceptance. When we practice, we may come to know, she says, the many ways we intentionally deceive in an attempt to escape deeply held assumptions about our identity. Aware of these deception patterns, we may be more likely to speak the truth when the moment of truth arises. And I can relate to this myself. I think one of my core challenges is in terms of accepting my Buddha nature. I can attempt to grasp that intellectually, but at kind of a gut level, I have a tendency to believe that I'm lacking in some way or deficient in some way. And I don't necessarily find myself thinking those thoughts and those words, but I think at a sort of gut automatic behavior fashion under certain circumstances when the chemistry's just right, I may react to certain situations, I think, as best I can understand this, reacting from that core belief that there's some deficiency I have to try and protect or compensate for, be careful about, as opposed to appreciating that I am complete as I am from the Buddhist perspective. Finally, she says, the belief we are lacking arises from the assumption there's something to attain. And she relates this back to the do not steal precept. The practice, for this precept includes opportunities to turn toward abundance. I think there's an opportunity to practice metta and acts of generosity. Focusing on the spiritual path of David Brooks' spiritual second mountain, which is, he says, a spiritual climb is an opportunity. I think for me, some of the things I think about are speaking up and speaking truth to power in some of the management teams that I'm part of, managing up within that team, focusing on addressing what the patient or the team needs, being fully present and observing falsehoods and exaggerations with a non-judgmental and gentle heart are some of the things I think about. So those are a few thoughts. Again, these sources are on the website. The one I mentioned that isn't there is this book by David Brooks, The Second Mountain. So a few thoughts. Bob, do you have any thoughts you want to add to that or any discussion?
Wow, that's quite a hard, that was a great presentation, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was really into that whole thing quite a bit. One of the articles that I was going to present in full, I can take an excerpt from. It's by Roshi Nancy Mujo Baker. From Tricycle, winter 2013 article called Non-Lying. And she has a fairly lengthy, many pages worth here. But let me just quote what she said. As adults practicing with the fourth precept, we need to not have a narrow view of lying. We are actually surrounded by lying. We not only lie personally to each other, and to ourselves, but we live in a society full of lies. Businesses lie, politicians lie, governments lie, teachers lie, students lie, doctors lie, patients lie. Imagine if we liars all suffered what happened to Pinocchio. The long noses would probably cause pedestrian traffic problems as well as require a redesign of our homes and workspaces. Perhaps all lying is manipulating situations to our advantage, whether the advantage is protection of whatever I take myself to be or a promotion of whatever I want others to take me to be. Since the word lying can have such harsh connotations for us, perhaps a better term for working with this precept is simply not telling the truth. When it comes to our personal failures to tell the truth, there are many versions. We need to use our imagination. We need to use our imagination to extend the narrower, more literal meaning of the precept in question to cover much more than we would normally think of. We do this in order to find the right version for our own practice and to make the precept come alive for each one of us. There is no one size fits all here. It is important also to not treat the precepts as moral principles. shoulds, should nots that are independent of us and thus fodder for our super egos. The next step after we uncover the various kinds of non-truth tellers we are is to welcome and allow them, not suppress or reject them. It's a much longer article, but I'll stop there. What's interesting is that I took that should and should not part as a dichotomy where we have, you know, things split into two opposing forces. And it's anathema to my understanding of Buddhism and the unity of all things, that these can't be separated into shoulds and should nots. But that's a much larger question. But I'll leave it there, Jeff. I don't know what you had in mind as far as breakout groups or whatever, but we've got probably another, while here. What do you want to do, Jeff?
I didn't have a specific plan for how to discuss that. Maybe Domeo or others are developing some sense of what works best in this situation, Domeo, or with this many people. I don't have a particular plan about how to discuss it.
It seems like, if you have specific questions or something, sometimes it's fun to break into breakout groups, but we seem to do just fine, like on Sunday. Just, it takes a little longer for people to speak, but I think we can probably, if we have problems with people talking over each other, we can use the chat function, but for the most part, I said, just kind of go ahead and unmute yourself and say something and have a conversation. And if somebody's talking and you want to talk next, there's a little chat bubble. If you move your cursor or your finger, you should be able to tap the chat bubble and type your name in, and then, I'll call on you next. But if you can't get that to work, sometimes people can't get it to work, then just go ahead and unmute yourself and jump in. So if anybody does want to speak up, please go ahead.
I don't have a question yet. I'm sure maybe if I thought about it some I would, but I just wanted to thank you both. That was a curveball you both got, and I thought you handled it very well. And I just appreciate what both of you said, and Jeff in particular, your honesty. It was wonderful, and I think it took a lot of courage. So thanks to you both.
You bet.
Jeff, Bob, this is Bruce.
Yay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You bet.
I have a question about karma related to this. Yeah, basically, I think you were saying that we're always making judgment calls, right? About what to say in a given situation. Was I correct in understanding that?
Well, I think the particular point about where I use that word judgment came out of Diane Rossetto's book. Uh-huh. And she says that as we are with ourselves throughout the day, or as we sit and we have this awareness arise that something's happening, or we're having some feelings, or we're having some discomfort, that if we receive that without judgment, if we try to avoid bringing judgmental reactions to our experiences, that we'll end up being more open to seeing all of the experience or all that is there. And that may then afford us the opportunity to go more deeply. understand ourselves more broadly. It cultivates a kind of climate or a setting that is more conducive to self-exploration if we can avoid judgment. So I think that's the point she was making. I don't believe she was relating that orientation to self as connected to karma so much. I did speak to the idea that Kjogan Carlson was pretty outspoken about, that each of the precepts has a koan embedded in the precept. Each of them has this, Diane refers to it as a riddle. There's maybe a paradox embedded in some of these precepts. The possibility that you might need to lie sometimes to protect another person, you know, and that might be okay to tell some lies. Some of those kinds of riddles or paradoxes. I don't know if that helps, Bruce,
yeah,
at all.
It does. That does help. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Others may want to comment on that too, of course.
This is James. Jeff, I just want to thank you for that wonderful talk as well. Very, very grateful for that.
Thank you.
The one thing that you said that really resonated with me is the piece about identity and how, you know, lying is really, or speaking non-truthfully is really a way to try to manipulate reality to your own creation, that you're actually fabricating a reality that's not really there, and doing so to save some part of your own ego identity that doesn't want to face reality as it really is. So that, that's really meant a lot to me as well. And as I have tried to practice this precept, that's the thing that really helps me to enact it in reality, as opposed to just saying, well, lying is bad because you're misleading people or whatnot, because that's all true, but that it actually comes back to just not accepting reality for what it is. So thank you very much again for that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd like to
experience an experience I'm having right now that I'm also remembering one of the writers speaking about this aspect of practicing the precepts, and that is that we have this wonderful opportunity to practice them in the Sangha community. One can pursue the precept in a very private way, and that can have value. But I think that if we are fortunate to have a fellowship community, to use a somewhat different set of words, then it's possible to create together a compassionate container, to use maybe still another metaphor, where we can all enter into this space together, pledge to be compassionate, pledge to be non-judgmental, practice that, and then help each other with this lifelong practice. And I found that concept of how to make use of the precepts to be very heartwarming and very encouraging, as I'm experiencing that right now with all of you. So.
So one of the things that one of the books I've been reading is this one. Let's see if you can see it. Yeah, I can't really see it. Anyway, it's Wholehearted, and he talks, interestingly enough, about lies of omission, which I think kind of touches a little bit about what James was pointing about reality and kind of, I suppose, also fear. Now touches in on that whole area of lies of omission. So I think that's a flip side of it. I think it's often easier to go there than necessarily lying directly, at least for me it is, because it requires a certain courage, a certain willingness to speak my truth that I don't always have. I just wanted to make that point.
Wonderful point. Thank you, Franklin.
If I could take us off on a slightly different tangent just for a moment.
Yeah.
I'm very analytical, and I was analyzing the exact wording of the precept. And the part that really got my goat for a long time was the quote, putting forth not one word. And it just puzzled me. It's like keeping silent. So to say anything is to lie, to speak an untruth because I say anything. And I've come to realize, yes, that's exactly what they mean. Let me give you an example. If I have a ball in my hand, pretend. If I describe the ball as simply the word red, then I am not telling the whole truth. I am leaving out the weight, the temperature, the texture, the squishiness, the center of gravity, the durability, the smell, and many other attributes. Now, think in terms of describing a person that you may be acquainted with, or maybe not even at all acquainted with, just that person over there. How well, how fully can you or me or anybody describe that person? So no matter what you say, it's incomplete. And according to this, an incomplete description is in itself not truthful. It's not the whole truth, as they say in court and so forth. I find that to be very illuminating. It may keep me more quiet than usual too. But it also points out the value of silence in Sesshin. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a wonderful metaphor you used, Bob, contrasting something relatively simple like a ball versus a human being. And then, okay, let's jump to the Dharma. Try to describe that accurately, let alone truthfully. Wow, that's a great illustration of that. One of the ways that I may lie is Franklin's comment about omissions made me think about this as exaggerations. I may be telling a story and it becomes a fish story where the fish is quite a bit longer than actually caught. That's a funny example of something maybe we all do, but then in other situations, that little touch of exaggeration, it doesn't necessarily serve any purpose except maybe to, I don't know, make my story look more entertaining. And I think that comes back to some need to, you know, impress or just be a little bit more entertaining or something by twisting the plot just a little bit. So I think I can't remember which of the authors talked about that one, but I chuckled my way through those examples that could relate to the exaggerations that don't serve much purpose except to, you know, enhance one's image or desires of the ego.
At least we're all Zen folks and we're fine with silence.
The truth of silence.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Wait. Go ahead. Do you want, I think you were first.
No, I don't have much of a comment. You go ahead.
Well, all I wanted to say, I haven't really been studying the precepts, but what occurred to me is when you, sometimes you think you are saying the truth, you're speaking the truth to someone about your experience, but there could be some self-deception there. So, for example, if I meet Domyo and I say, this is my experience of the Dharma right now, but if I really haven't sat with it and sat with it and felt it to be true, and I brought that to her, I just said something, then she's going to meet me from what I've said. And then I could miss this opportunity for her to really connect with what's bothering me. Do you know what I'm saying? It happens because, yeah, it's just self-deception, and you mislead people then, and then you just like ships passing in the night, right? So sometimes maybe it's better to sit with someone and not say anything. Maybe that will speak more than what you want to say.
Oh, that's a cool idea, Myoju. Just sitting together in the truth of silence. Are you still there, Myoju? Your screen just went black. There you are.
Now you're back. I have a question to throw out for people. Once again, the precepts are so, they don't really answer any questions for you as to how you should behave. You know, they really just point toward a question, point toward a point of responsibility, because, you know, there, on the other hand, there's the sense of some people, and sometimes we do want to speak honestly, right, about how we feel and what our opinions are and whatever. And there's times where that is not, that just serves the ego as well, or that's not very helpful. Yeah. So I kind of throw that out there, like, what about that? Mm. What about that kind of speech? That,
well, I keep coming back, and I think it's the Bodhidharma comment. I don't have the precept right in front of me. But putting forth not one word is the precept of not lying. Is that Bodhidharma?
Dogen.
Is it the first one or the second one?
First one.
That's the first one.
Well, it made me, first of all, it put me in mind of why Bodhidharma never really says anything, right? I mean, if you hear the stories about him and the koans and so forth, I've never seen him say more than three words. And it's usually one. But the question you just asked, Domyo, to me makes a lot of sense. I love the concept that the only way to really tell the truth is not say anything. As soon as I render an opinion, I mean, that's a very humbling thing, and it's a very hard concept to work with. But when I do dig into these precepts, that always comes up for me. And then I realize that, you know, what's in my head is just not true. It's just not. And So if we are not saying anything, then we are not feeding our egos. And sooner or later, they'll just float away and die of starvation. And we'll be in the world of no self.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a corollary question. So the fact that we're talking in this manner, in this context, is that a violation of the precept? I'm going to not talk now.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny. I've been thinking about that same thing recently because, you know, I have a friend I'll talk to about my life, and then she'll give me her opinion, her truth of what's going on with me. It's not right exactly, but I don't know how to tell her because she just wants to help me. And so I've been thinking, if someone talks to you, it's better to just listen. They don't want my opinion of their life. So yeah, that's, I guess that's telling the truth, is just listening to someone.
Wow.
It's one of the things I've been dealing with, working on the sixth precept. But if we stop talking, we have the opportunity to have an intimate conversation, if you will, or relationship or whatever, an intimate moment with another person.
Cool.
On the other hand, what about compassionate speech and support of one another and teaching the Dharma? And it's like the koan of the,
yeah,
the guy who's he's just about to fall out of a tree, and he's grasping onto the branch with his teeth, and somebody comes by and asks him a Dharma question. The idea is that this is like he's supposed to answer. He's supposed to give his best answer that he can. But if he does, he dies. You know, because there is, like what somebody was saying earlier, like, what about, I mean, you know, silence. What do they say? I mean, through our silence, we allow injustice. We you know, so, geez.
I think one of the things that I do to kind of put into context truth when I'm speaking is to use the word "it occur," you know, the phrase "it occurs to me," because it's just sort of this admission that it may not be the truth. It's just how it occurs to me, and that somebody else's truth may be different. It doesn't necessarily answer the question you were saying, but that was just something that I was thinking.
Well, it occurs to me too that, I don't know, if we just understand maybe that truth is always moving. What was the Jeff, did you tell that story about the it just moved? That it's not a fixed thing. But that we have to communicate. So it occurs to me, like, you know, Bob is describing this ball, right? Somebody says, you know, please tell me what that is. So describe it to me. And I'm like, well, I mean, it's red, and it's, you know, it's always going to be incomplete. But that's okay. Like, maybe if we acknowledge that the truth is always moving, but here it occurred, this is what it looks like to me right now.
Wondering if it's also about if the truth is serving your ego personally, or if it's really serving life. And when you make rules about speaking or not speaking, I think that's serving ego. And I know someone who, when she's silent, that means she is livid. I mean, she is close to rage. And if you notice how she puts things down and moves and walks, the anger is just permeating every single air molecule, but she's not saying a word. It's not much different than someone who's expressing anger all over you. So I don't think it's about being silent or speaking. It's whether whom are you serving when you are silent, and whom are you serving when you are speaking? Is it yourself or life? It's anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that was kind of, I was half kidding when I said what I said about should we even be speaking in this context. And the reason I said that was because to what extent are we, when we respond in this sort of way, how much of that is our ego, right? That was really what I was trying to say. And to the extent that it is, maybe we shouldn't talk.
There's also the concept of active listening, where you listen to a person say something, and then you reflect back what you think, what you heard. I think that's speaking in service of both of you, you know, both you and the other person, but I think it's a gift to them that you're trying to understand them or clarify what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have like 1 minute left to Jeff and or Bob want to say a closing word or two?
Bob, go ahead.
Just thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you all. It's, you know, great to be together and talk about these things.
So I will, I'll end with a little verse then. And just because I want to share, I found a little function on Zoom that I could lock the meeting. So I didn't have to spend this whole discussion period
or
somebody jumping on. That meant that if you fell off, you couldn't get back on, but but that was nice. That was a relief. All right, so we offer the merit of this practice session to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna.
Hi.
Bye. Have a good evening.
Bye, everybody. Throw me up.